Howard Lindzen, the man, the myth, your return to Real Vision. It's been a long time. We've waited. Everybody, I must have had 3,000 emails say you've got to bring Howard back.
Who? You have a lot of drunk listeners.
Howard, just for people who aren't so familiar with your background, give us a bit about your background and your journey to where you are today.
I am Canadian, so it may come in handy at some point soon. It's funny because I haven't been home in a while because of COVID, but I split my time Phoenix, San Diego, and born in, like I said, in Toronto, but moved to the States, go to Arizona State, Harvard of the West for my MBA in a school called Thunderbird. And then I just stayed in the desert, learning how to invest, starting companies, probably claimed to fame 2006. I started a show called Wall Strip, which became the first web video show acquired by a major media network. So that was it was a fun ride. And then inspired by Twitter, I jumped out of CBS about my way out of my contract with about 6 months to go at CBS and started StockTwits, which is Twitter for finance. And now we're probably, at least in the States, the largest social network for traders and investors with about 5 million members talking about stocks. If you love stocks, you love talking about them all day long. And you don't mind a scrum, an American swearing scrum. StockTwits is the place where you wore the hell me out. We have a great CEO in there now who we're really excited. It's a profitable company, lean, mean. And I invest out of Social Leverage. My partners and I have a fund called Social Leverage that we invest out of. And that's my dog, Lindsay, who's got a chew toy. Hopefully my wife will grab.
My dogs usually make an appearance in the video. So talk me through Social Leverage. What is it you do? You've had some big successes there. Because what I want to do is just get a bit of an understanding. And then I want to talk about where things are going and the stuff that you're seeing. Because this whole kind of campaign we're doing over 2 weeks is really, has everything changed? I don't want to pick your brains about it, but I'd love to hear a bit about Social Leverage, what you guys have done, because I think you're about to raise a fourth fund now.
Social Leverage started out while I was starting StockTwits. It was my personal investing. I was seeing so many companies, 2007, 2008, 2009. I didn't have a formal entity. And my partner, Tom, and I started a holding company called Social Leverage. And we were just investing our own capital. And 2013, we formalized it with a first fund, a $6 million fund. We made 34 investments. And then we did a second fund, a $25 million fund, added a third partner, Gary Bennett, who had started Assistly, which we had invested in and sold it to Salesforce. And he was just leaving Salesforce after his burnout. And then fund three was $45 million, which we're investing out of now. And then we'll in the process of raising our fourth fund, about a $75 million fund. We're first checks. $1 million board seat, hands-on, and our the basic thesis was in 2008 we saw this move from financial leverage to social leverage. That was the social networks of Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn. They were exploding, and you could piggyback on them. They hadn't figured out the arbitrage of what a user was worth. Today, you go and you pay top dollar for a user, right? We're seeing that with DTC. Companies, etc. You pay. They figured out how to charge you properly for that. But back then, everybody was building companies kind of for free on the backs of those social networks. Anyways, and we focused on financial services. So claim to fame, I guess, in the fund is we're early investors, seed investors in Robinhood, and today it's an $11 billion company.
I'm just fascinated. So you take a bunch of different bets in the fund when you start. How many of those are zeros, and how many of those end up as meaningful things? Because it's a very different world, VC investing, to the world that I know, because you have to deal with the zeros as well as the Robin Hoods. How does that whole process work?
Well, I mean, I find it interesting. Well, first of all, we're in a bull market. So let's just call it a boom, call it a bubble, call it whatever you want. But we're in this new, I hate saying the word new paradigm, but we are in a software-driven world with high margins, much easier to scale in a lean way. So the failure rate, surprisingly, is much lower. Plus, in a world where these humongous planets, Salesforce, Facebook, Microsoft, Google, Amazon, Netflix exist, the talent is paid for. So even if, kind of like the old days, maybe with car mechanics, they could always get a job. If you have great engineers, there's always a soft landing for some for these software companies, you know, a million ahead. So it's almost hard to lose money. But in the end, yes, most seed funds or 70% of seed funds I've read do not return all their capital. So it's not an easy business. It's definitely a picker's type of business still and a networking type of business. And Social Leverage has just over the years positioned itself with strong opinions, theme-based approach to financial services and enterprise investing, obviously experience and deep domain experience around that. And we just keep doing the same thing. But software has something where there's just outsized gains to be had from picking winners in the software space, probably because of the margins, probably because of the growth ability, probably because of the ability of global, social, mobile to just go everywhere quickly. You're seeing these just outsized winners where even people like me, you invest in companies that are under $5 or $10 million valuation and you have multi-billion dollar exits. It's hard to fathom this. Right. Because when I'm 55. So when I was starting my business career in the 90s, there was no internet. So a good consumer product that I had at one of my first companies went on QVC, and a good business, you know, was waiting for QVC to pay you because they were the internet before the internet. Right. You know, QVC held all the cards. Now all the cards are held in the ether. And we're seeing that even with decentralization. So the failure rate is not as high as, let's say, mom, pa, store. So I would say our failure rate's pretty low still over the course of these first three funds. Obviously, we expect a lot of companies not to work. But because of power laws, it's just one or two companies that just explode that pay for everything. So you have to be good at still picking winners.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
You had a vision pretty early on about kind of, we can call it fintech. I don't know what you saw back then. You kind of saw the decentralization of finance. What gave you that thought? Because it was very ahead of the game, really, because, you know, you started StockTwits, but very few people had gotten into that idea. It was still a world dominated by investment banks and a few major brokerages. Why did you think everything was about to change?
Well, even getting connected to someone like you through who's now running a public company through Subneet, right?
Yeah.
I in the pre-internet world, you know, an MBA from ASU, I joke about it, like, what the hell is that worth, right? In the world post-internet, it was just, you know, I was going to ASU for the sun and the golf and get the MBA, but you're not going to go to Wall Street with that, or you're not going to go to work at any of the premier companies per se, right? You're self-selecting yourself to a life of leisure. Which kind of I was, but I was an entrepreneur at heart, had a huge break with my first company, The Grip, which was the product we sold to QVC. And I just got exposed to growth and to industry and great entrepreneurship. And I started a hedge fund, you know, cause I'm an idiot because my little company was making so much money with my partner. We were managing our own money in the 90s. And I was on the other side of the phone call, just calling brokers, learning the market and getting ripped off, but actually making money because in the 90s, the semiconductors and healthcare were going up. So of course, I started a hedge fund because that was the entrepreneurial thing to do. And I hated it. By 2005, I was miserable. I would be the guy talking to my television going, why is that same guy having an opinion on everything? And I wasn't exposed to the world of Bloomberg. I didn't have enough capital to pay for a Bloomberg. So I was using Yahoo Finance and thestreet.com, and I was miserable. And so when YouTube came out, I said, I'm going to build CNBC on YouTube. That was my giant epiphany with no background in production and making content. I was a poor stand-up comedian in Toronto as a young kid. And so the whole idea was, I'm going to create a show on YouTube. I'm going to create CNBC on YouTube. And I pinged Fred Wilson, who randomly at backtostreet.com. I actually didn't know that at the time. And I said, I'm going to do, kind of CNBC on YouTube. And we had been friends back and forth on his blog back then. It was pre-Twitter. And he said, you know what? I'm good. He gave me $50K and he called Mark Pincus. He called Brad Feld. He called all the best investors in the world. He gave me their phone number. And he said, just start dialing. This is like, this is still the era of the BlackBerry, bro. Fred Wilson goes, I'm in for $50K. And he starts handing me out phone numbers. And I literally went through 10 phone numbers of Fred Wilson. And each one of them said yes, like, because it was a referral from Fred. You know, hi, this is Howard Lenzen. I'm an idiot. I went to ASU. I got a show. I'm going to build CNBC on YouTube. Fred Wilson's in for $50K. And then everybody was like, yeah, I'm in for $25K. So I thought VC were like dumb people. I mean, you just pick up the phone and call them and the money comes in. So I raised $600,000 to build this idea, like you're doing Real Vision today. And we would make these 3-minute silly, trends. It was about trends shows on YouTube. And we would spread them across Vio, Rever. Back then there was 100 video sites and YouTube kind of came into the leadership role. So at the time we would make the show and really the hard work was after, because you had to distribute it to like 40 different places. So it was like a weird phenomenon. Like YouTube wasn't dominant. And so you just had to send your video everywhere. And that kind of led to a lot of other investments, because now I'm in the video business or in the distribution business or making my own content business. So I got to like figure out how to not just make the show, but get it seen by as many people, because they weren't all just on one or two sites. So that was kind of the thing. And because CBS bought it, we didn't have revenues, et cetera. We were kind of inventing what was going on. And then when Twitter came out, so it's between YouTube and Twitter. Twitter came out and I said, that's going to be Bloomberg, right? And I went to Fred Wilson and I sent him a message on my BlackBerry saying, I love RIM. And back then, you were using your BlackBerry, you were pinning or sending messages. And I put a dollar sign in front of RIM because if you used a hashtag, it was full of spam Twitter already, even back in 2007. And Fred sent me back a message saying, genius, you should start a company. And off I went, with StockTwits, which is now 12 years. Now, so that was my epiphany. First YouTube for, and we haven't seen that until Real Vision. And even today, maybe Davey Barstool's doing stuff everywhere. But we still have not seen that CNBC of YouTube, right? That where people spend hours a day and it's their channel. I don't know why people watch CNBC. That's kind of my thing. So I haven't watched it in 10 years.
It was Cheddar, but they didn't seem to make any content that anybody actually watched.
Yeah, I think John's genius on that, because I didn't get it. I still don't get it. But John was just such a great entrepreneur and hustler that he had this vision around distribution over content first, and you got to choose one or the other. And so he just went all out top down, like get it everywhere, worry about the content later in many ways. And that worked, he found a buyer. It's a beautiful country. You can't predict what's going to happen, but there is this giant void. You had Cheddar, which sold for a lot of money, but didn't really have a there, right? And then you have CNBC, which just gets worse, in my opinion. Though I don't watch, it gets worse from what I can hear. But people still, it's like their wet blanket. And then there's FinTwit, which is not really good enough, right? It's a bunch of people pontificating and yelling. And you could obviously say the same thing about StockTwits, but we're there because we care about stocks, and that's all we care about, right? Stuff gets pulled. So it's a very focused kind of microservice blogging service. But the key thing, going back to like wrapping it all together for you, which your question was financial services, I didn't have any kind of great genius, right? Like, I'd love to say that I'm a genius about this. I've been called clever, and Fred thought the dollar sign was genius, right? I'm really proud of the cash tag and that, because it gave us a way to parse people that had intent to talk about stocks, right? But what happened was, by using Twitter so much and seeing so many smart people kind of integrate and partner and use the dollar sign and do this, I started saying, why isn't the trade connected to the dollar sign? And this is why I'm always like aggravated with Twitter, and they've underachieved. You should be able to trade. If Raoul Paul or Howard Lenzen or Mark Andreessen or Chamath or anybody that we trust is out there throwing tickers around, you should be able to just one click trade and then share that trade. Like, that's social trading. That's social dissemination. That's that old cartoon, buy, 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 sell, 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 sell. That's what Twitter really is. And you can't really connect the two because Twitter didn't really want to go into the transaction layer, right? So when I saw Robinhood, I'm like, okay, if you guys build this, a true mobile free trading brokerage, okay, this thing will be ginormous. This was back in 2013 when I met them.
What was their pitch?
Their pitch was, the company was called Kronos Research. They were out of money, Baiju and Vlad. It's a funny story. Because of stock, I was kind of a wimp in hindsight. I didn't want it. In 2013, if you were going to be a broker dealer, you were the sucker. Like, no one wants to be a broker dealer, right? But so I kind of dropped the ball there because I didn't want to be, I didn't want to be governed by the SEC and FINRA. Stock was just a simple communication product. What Robinhood's genius was, is they got a great designer. They really understood high frequency trading because Kronos Research, the company that became Robinhood, they had started out a high frequency trading operation and they just couldn't figure out how to make money. I don't even know the whole story, but when they came to me, they showed me this app in 2013. It kind of looks the exact same it is today. They didn't have their FINRA license. They didn't have the SEC approval. But I said, listen, if you build this app and we integrate it into StockTwits and you let people share their trades wherever, now they're shared on Reddit and everywhere else, is people will go bananas. That was just my prediction. And then the other thing that when people kept saying to me at Social Leverage, well, this will never make money. This will never make money. Well, that's not how Silicon Valley seed stage investing works. Part of software investing, and now we're seeing it with open source, right? Because I do a lot of interviews with open source, is the arbitrage of getting a user. Because Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn have figured out how to charge the exact amount for a user pretty much compared to where it was in 2007, 2008, the true growth of a company becomes from being able to arb the cost of a customer acquisition at a much fairer rate than YouTube, Facebook, et cetera. So we focus a lot on companies that have this hidden ability to arbitrage customer acquisition. And I knew Robinhood was the first company that you would buy one share of Google and show it like a Snapchat to your friend. Okay, you can't do that on Schwab, Ameritrade. They're still paying $300-$400 a customer for customer acquisition. So was Wealthfront and Betterment. So there was really no, all the robos were paying the same with no switching costs. So with Robinhood, what they became, they got like a Snapchat effect because people would show off their screen and show off their trades. So they were acquiring customers at $0. So I figured if they can acquire a million customers over the next 10 years, this is the way I was thinking, at $0 versus Ameritrade at $350, well, you built a $350 million company. Well, here we are, 10 to $20 million customers later. They're probably going to do 700 to a billion this year based on my guesstimates of, you know, of piecing together the news clippings, and they have 10 to 12 million. So no wonder they're worth 11 billion. Now, are they really worth it? I don't care. Like, I mean, we've sold a little stock along the way at Social Leverage, but I mean, what, you know, of all the epiphanies I had, that was the best one. And I still believe that epiphany is going to happen. I still believe there's a Bloomberg, not necessarily a terminal. You can't recreate Bloomberg, but I think death by a thousand cuts in the United States, this constellation approach, jujitsu, where you have Coifin for charts and you have, Y charts if you're an RIA, and you have Real Vision if you want deep discussions. You have podcasts on Spotify, you have StockTwits, you have Reddit, you have whatever you want. And so it's up to the user. I would say this today, Raul, is like everybody, you know, we complained back in the 80s, you know, the small guy had no chance. Well, in 2020, every single person on the planet has inside information if they know how to use the tools, right?
This is the huge difference, right?
Yeah.
It's, you know, when we started Real Vision, it was democratizing financial information. And that's what's happened. Everybody gets the kind of access that nobody used to have before.
Yeah, and we're still complaining about it, which is beautiful. That's the opportunity. There's still people yelling while there's just... and tremendous information. You know, I'm going to have Chamath on my show. You're going to have some of the best. You have some of the best investors on your show, just sharing for free. And no one even it seems like no one even wants it at some level. So I find like the stuff that you're doing on the macro and the podcast, stuff that I never thought I'd be into, is the stuff that I like the best. Long form, build relationships with smart people, to know, you know, being a smart node for other people and sharing information. I just cannot believe the alpha and the signal that's out there. And so I'm just keeping my head down, sharing as much as I can. And I can't believe it every day that I wake up that there's just this much alpha. Now, I don't understand the markets any better than I understood them 20 years ago, maybe less. The more work I do, the dumber I feel sometimes, right? Like, you know, with Davey Barstool saying stocks only go up and the word stonks and BTFD and all the things that I helped, you know, push. But I've also never felt more in tune with the markets because, you know, I feel that they're politicized. I feel I know who to check in with to give me that reality, you know? And I think more than ever, it's a behavioral driven market. And there's a lot of new people we're competing against. And then the biggest trend, sorry, Ro, I don't know what you finished. What people don't see is they're still making fun of this, but what they don't see is that this American pastime is like the new baseball, right? And COVID might have accelerated that. But I always thought it was coming. So as much as people give me credit for being early to this, it's a fucking nightmare waiting 10 years for this stuff to take off.
But you've been saying this was coming.
Yeah. Like, Robinhood, the iTunes, the Apple Store came out, into the iOS apps, 2008 or 2009. Robinhood did not, this was all Twitters to get. The fact is, DraftKings, which is a $20 billion company, and Robinhood, which is going to be a $20 billion brand and company in the next 5 years, if they continue at this pace, maybe more. Those are all Twitter products. Those were all simple hacks that the board at Twitter let Jack go create Square, which is also like Twitter is let Square, forgetting about all the other things they screwed up, Square, DraftKings, Robinhood should all be part of the ecosystem. Twitter was Bloomberg. If you really think about the three things they missed, you know, Coifin or some kind of charting product, some kind of, you know, 24-hour video business channels. Sports and if you look at Bloomberg, sports and business are the two verticals. So Twitter had those people. They have the athletes and they have the traders on Twitter because of the real time. So they haven't corralled the three biggest businesses that they let get away from them. Square, which they let leave their own house. DraftKings they could have bought for a song over the last 10 years. And then Robinhood, they, you know, probably still a cheap acquisition. If they were serious about doing business, they wrap themselves in free speech, et cetera, and that's just let all these other businesses happen. I will say finally that international is going to blow people's minds. You know, Robinhood tried to get into UK and Australia, and they've kind of recently pulled out for whatever reasons, I don't know. Maybe just too hard or the margins from with Citadel from maybe you're not allowed to do that in the rest of the world, the order flow. And so I'm also an investor in eToro, which is the Robinhood and Coinbase combined of the rest of the world. They're in 140 countries, started in 2009, and they'll do close to $1 billion in sales this year. Nobody in America has heard of them. And so you've got Robinhood in the US, you have eToro in 140 other countries. But then you have now hundreds of other countries that are going to clone Robinhood and use like the Plaids of the world. And, you know, we're investors in Alpaca and there's Drive Wealth, which has got great investors in it. And Apex is old school, powering these brokers. So there's brokers that you've never heard of that can spin up with a good brand in Singapore or in India, or there's 10 of them in China and there's 10 of them in India and then Africa. And so what we're seeing is early stages is if you look at the 10 most bought stocks in like Brazil, it's Tesla, Amazon. So there's a global demand imbalance from people investing fractional amounts in these other countries. So it's not just Americans that want these stocks. It's the last great bastion of American culture.
I mean, it's amazing because all the young people have suddenly finally stampeded in and COVID was the creator. Obviously, it makes us all a bit nervous. And I think you've always been pretty open about this, saying, listen, everyone's going to have to learn a lesson. Markets go up, markets go down, and that's part of the game. Mm-hmm. But it kind of feels like it's a slight shame to drag everybody in at all-time record valuations in a market that almost makes no sense whatsoever. And now that doesn't mean it can't keep going up, but it's just like, it kind of feels like you've got lambs to the slaughter a bit.
Yeah. And I'll say this is one of my biggest positions, you know, but I would say this to you, Ro, because I just talked to Chaitin at Benchmark and then Ross Mason, who was the CEO of MuleSoft, founder of CEO of MuleSoft, that sold MuleSoft 2 years ago for $6 billion to Salesforce at a 21 times sales. And everybody was laughing. And, you know, because Salesforce does a lot of whack big acquisitions, some don't work. But this one, the next year, they paid the equivalent of 7 times sales because MuleSoft grew at 100-something%, grew faster than it ever had grown under Salesforce. You know, after 15 years, it grew faster than it had ever grown at its size under Salesforce. So who are we to say? I kind of say this is the era. There's just not enough supply of the right companies. You know, we went from 8,000 stocks to 4,000 stocks, of which of those 4,000 stocks, 3,600 of them are turds, right? The private equity stock bounced around. They're full of financial leverage. There's no true hooked up to the cloud open source companies. Right now, there's two pure public companies that are open source. Not that open source is a great business. Those are founders making crazy decisions to start companies where they give away their product for free. And so Mongo and Elastic are basically the only, if I was going to start an open source ETF, there's two companies. Okay. So in a world where there's going to be 100 open source companies,
is it because it's still owned by VC? Is it because it's still owned by VCs that nobody's going public?
Because these things, the open source companies take forever to get to a revenue that will allow them to go public, first of all. Okay. Secondly, halfway through their life in the first 10 years, Amazon comes along and says, we're going to just steal it. And Microsoft comes along and either buys it. So you've got these big giant companies ready to buy open source. So basically Salesforce became, everybody wants to be a platform. If you listen to Ross or you listen to Benchmark, and that makes sense. We all want to be platforms. Real Vision wants to be a platform. StockTwits wants to be a platform. So does Microsoft. So does Amazon. So what they're going to do is buy up these open source companies. That's why there's only two of them. So in a world where there's not enough supply of great pure software companies, maybe the young guys are smart. If they're coming in to buy Carnival Cruise Line and airlines, maybe, you know, they deserve to get slaughtered. But if they're coming in to buy the NASDAQ 100, I think it's just a supply demand issue. So yes, there's huge multiple contraction risk in the market. That's kind of the risk that I see in talking to great VCs. Good luck timing that. And good luck understanding truly shorting a stock based on the hope of multiple contraction in a world of endless money and in a world of zero interest rates. That's the one thing that of all the things that I'm a 55-year-old nervous Canadian Nelly, and I always have one foot out the door, so I'm not making as much as I should. But thank goodness I don't short stocks, and I learned that early, because being on the other side of this trade makes less sense than being long, in my opinion. And, but at the same time, I think we'll have more issues like March because, you know, everybody's connected and everybody panics at the same time. And if you got, you know, so I think we'll have more volatility as well.
I just think, as you're alluding to, you know, these are businesses. I mean, this is a whole different world. General Electric, I don't know what its margin is, but it's like probably 12% or something. Every one of these companies is 60, 70, 80%.
90. 90. StockTwits has over 90% gross margins, I mean, and growing faster than ever.
So what do you? What does that mean?
My
for
dog.
Valuation? I mean, what is that? I mean, it's impossible to know. I think is what you're saying.
That's what I say.
I agree. I mean, I think Stan Druckenmiller has been another guy who's been on this one trend. He's like, this is going to happen.
Here's the other thing that's going to happen. So if you have time for this, is you have a world. I never was going to buy bonds. I never understood bonds. That's a world of that you understood and CFAs understood. So with the combination of the whitewashing of CFAs, if you're a CFA, you're working on a spreadsheet about the cloud when we haven't decided what the TAM, we haven't been close to capturing what the value of the cloud is. Just the three private clouds, Microsoft, Amazon, and Google, have $75 billion. And that doesn't sound like a lot, really, but just those three are $75 billion. Okay, so when you say a CFA, what the hell does a CFA mean in 2020, right? You know, a graphic designer has more insight into the size of the markets than a CFA does. So you throw out the spreadsheet, okay? So in 2000, in the bubble, they said, throw out the spreadsheet, the internet's going to be huge. But the cost of starting a business, the cost of acquiring a customer, the cost of the hardware, you know, there was no cloud. So those businesses, you know, the cat came home to roost. Right now, we're talking about companies that are 15 years old, growing faster than they've ever grown before, right? Salesforce, et cetera, by doing acquisitions, and Amazon growing faster than they've ever grown before. It used to be you went public and sales would slow automatically. Now you go public late, which we've been complaining about, and sales are just getting going. Twilio just had their best quarter of all time, you know? So, and Microsoft just came in to compete with them. So it's just a kind of a new paradigm.
Yeah, I was thinking this through the other day as well. I was just thinking, you know, Google hasn't been executing particularly well. I mean, I asked you this question, and I'm like, fuck, these guys own all the world's data. And once they figure out how to leverage that again, this company's worth $2 trillion, $3 trillion, $4 trillion, $5 trillion. I mean, it's unparalleled.
There's no spreadsheet. That's what I'm saying. So some analyst on Wall Street, this is a mood. We're in a mood-based risk-on, risk-off environment. Google's worth $500 billion or $5 trillion. Okay? The closer it gets to $500 billion, I'll buy stock. Okay? The closer it gets to $5 trillion, I'll sell stock. You know, that's the way I look at Apple. Once it got to $2 trillion, like my mind couldn't grasp the numbers, and I don't care if it goes to $4 trillion. I sold a lot, and I switched into other tech stocks. But the more smart, and I'm not saying they're investing smart, I'm saying the more smart open source and software founders that I talk to, and I know you get to talk to them too, Matthew Prince at Cloudflare, I was texting with them, and this is a very conservative guy who runs Cloudflare, you know, and I own the stock, and we don't talk about his company, but you know, I'll say, what do you think about this market? And he'll say, well, I don't know where else I would put my money. And these are smart people saying stuff that we would 20 years ago say, oh, that's a sign of the top. When really smart people are saying, I got no other choice to put my money, that's usually not a good sign. But they truly don't have a place to put their money. Bonds are a joke. If you're an asset allocator and you've got 40% of your client's money in bonds, I don't know, you're steering your client off a cliff. The advisors need to move their clients to a different paradigm. Maybe it's 40% stocks, 30% cash, 30% early stage investing, but everybody needs to go further out. In a software world, people need to go further out on the risk spectrum. In a world where we're socially distant, okay, people are going to downsize into smaller places. Maybe they'll have 10 homes, but they'll all be 2,000 square feet or 1,500 square feet, and they'll all have Restoration Hardware, Farfetch clothing, Lululemon, Nike stuff, and you just have little places around the country that are yours, right? And they're just kind of like pods where you have the same clothing and you know, you don't have to have suits, we don't have to have dress shoes, we don't have to have, you know, jewelry. It's just, you know, and in a world like that, I mean, we're just getting started. And so that's the weird thing, is that the old economy seems to be getting worse, and people are in denial about the old economy. I call them civilian-based stocks like Simon Property Group. And they'll have to reimagine themselves too. But then you have the new economy, which may just still be undervalued because there's no supply and too much demand.
And where does crypto fit into all of this? And you know, in the broad context, not just in Bitcoin, but the whole, because I know you've been looking at that space as well.
Yeah, I've been lucky because my proxies for Bitcoin have been Bitcoin itself. So I own enough that it's worked, and you know, probably not enough, sorry, but I own enough that it's like, you know, it's fun. But I don't use it, so it doesn't make sense to me still. But through eToro and Robinhood, those are kind of my crypto investments, right? Because I get exposure to what people use crypto for, trading and holding and looking at in their accounts. And but in terms of like applications, I'm a little discouraged. Maybe because I live in America and we don't, you know, PayPal and Square work and cash still works and your debit card still works and you pay your Visa and MasterCard, they're the railroads and everything kind of works. So I think as an American, I'm probably at a disadvantage because I'm never going to really see it work, or at least in my lifetime, I'm starting to think that. And if I do see it work, we got other problems. Like if Bitcoin becomes really important tomorrow and goes to 50,000, I think we have other problems that scare me.
And what about the rise of the retail investor in that space? It feels like that is going to attract more and more people. That folds into your thesis overall that, you know, this is a space that there is an ability for people to participate.
Participate early. Like a Bitcoin was, you could have bought it at 12 cents. You know, Yoni at eToro in 2010 was telling me to buy eToro at 12 cents. The only solace that I have for not buying is that my money would have been in Mt. Gox and I would have lost it anyway. So, I mean, that's what I do to put myself to sleep at night. I think what we learn with tokens is, I think one of the great things about America still, and this is why I hate the drumbeat of taking down all institutions and like an unabashed freedom, right? We've got unabashed freedom with tokens. You know what we got? A global penny stock market, right? And you got what you deserve, pink sheets on rails, you know. And there's nothing wrong with the SEC at some levels. Yeah, they don't know what they're doing, and the IRS doesn't know what they're doing. But it gives you some basis to lean against. And you need some level of centralization, at least I do at my age. You know, you're not going to get me doing this. And so I think companies with cash flow, you know, and earnings, as crazy as the multiple seem, is a lot better than some decentralized place to blow your brains out. Not against crypto and people trading and learning, but I still am a sucker for and a believer in the institution of the SEC and some rules and regulations and some level of accountability. I just don't think in a global open world of sharks that the average person has much of a chance. And in a world where there's somebody to lean against and everybody has information, I think the markets become more important than ever, but we'll see. You know, 2017 was a tough year for tokens and crypto. You know, you gave people what they wanted, and it was kind of like a 1999. And I don't see any of the. And personally, I have some money in a couple funds, and that's how I watch it. But eToro and Robinhood still seem to be the best place to participate for me in crypto.
So outside of those two investments, looking forward, what are you most excited about that you think, okay, I got something really interesting here that nobody's seeing? Now, obviously, with a caveat, you could be dead wrong, but...
Yeah. So I continue to do more of the same. I continue, Gary, my partner, who's a whiz at enterprise. Gary focuses on enterprise software. He worked 4 years at desktop, like basically running desk.com for Salesforce with his partner because they bought a Sysly. So there's a PayPal, there's a Salesforce mafia, an enterprise mafia. And Tom Tungaz, who's at Redpoint, is a great writer, very simple blog that anybody can follow for free. He talks about enterprise still being, you know, if you get 1% of Salesforce's market, you're $1 billion, of their revenue, you're $1 billion company. So we're still very early in enterprise, but my partner Gary handles that. In financial services, I think we're extremely early. You know, this passive market has always not made sense to me. And this 60-40, 70-30 split amongst that advisors are pitching their clients, that 30 and 40 needs to find other ways to invest. So alts, I'm super bullish on alts, as little as I'm not a private equity person, super bullish on alts. We're investors in a company called Rally Road, which does IPOs for collectibles and fractional ownership of collectibles. I mean, they put up an item that's interesting and it sells out in 3 minutes. We invest in a company called Alpaca, alpaca.markets, which is a, let's call it an API for quants and an API for traders. So you can hook up and trade for free, algorithm type trading and back test and do everything. It's an incredible company. So they'll power, if I'm right, Alpaca, or if we're right, at Social Leverage, they'll power thousands of Robinhoods around the world, right? That want to spin up, but don't want to set up their own broker dealer and don't want to set up all their, and build that trust because Alpaca's got the stack that Robinhood has of building their own clearing firm. So a lot of infrastructure that will support a global, let's call it a global epidemic of equity and alternative investing. So I don't think we've seen anything yet. You know, Brazil has XP, which is like kind of an interactive brokers and bigger than Schwab already. So if Brazil has a company bigger than Schwab, I mean.
And India is another place that's
massive,
financializing so fast.
Why India is not for me is it's just, we don't have a big enough firm. You know, I've got to pick my bets. If you had told me, and we're going to announce a big deal here in international. If you had told me that Social Leverage, you know, a four-person shop with no staff, you know, we're just over 100 million under management, and you know, we've done very well, was going to have to. I used to say this joke: if you have to go do international investing, you're just not working hard enough, right? Like you hear these people talk about emerging market. You're managing 60 grand. Why are you talking about emerging markets? You can't find an American company to like satisfy your needs, you lazy fuck. You stupid lazy fuck. So I was that guy always preaching. If you can't find opportunities for your first billion in the United States, you're kind of looking to lose money. Well, here I am in 2020, so excited because it's just a layup to see what Americans love and what the Chinese love converging on the rest of the world. And for me, investing is so obvious. To see people's face light up, if you're going to lose all your, if you go to Mexico, right, there's like one stock to buy. There's 130 million people in Mexico. There's like 400,000 brokerage accounts in all of Mexico. So when you give those people the chance to buy $4 worth of Tesla versus $4 worth of CMEX, they're going to buy Tesla. Now, they may be wrong, but I like their upside over 10 years in Tesla over CMEX. And if they're wrong on a basket of American brands, well, we're all in trouble. But at the same time, the odds that they're going to be wrong on a basket of 10 NASDAQ 100 stocks is pretty low compared to their choices at home. So, and America's building the tools that will power all this. So America needs to embrace what they're good at again and stop, fighting and trying to hold back progress. So, I'm super bullish on the rest of the world, at least as it pertains to, investing.
Listen, Howard, that's super interesting. I think you've been really, really ahead of this. And while most people I see are becoming more and more cynical with everything, You're actually doing the opposite and saying, sure, there's a bunch of old broken stuff, but look through what's actually going on. And there's some huge changes and another enormous wave starting where people want to participate in innovation.
It's just participation, it's access, it's... And I have to pinch myself sometimes because I don't want to steer people off a cliff. I think investing is risky, especially in technology if you don't understand it. But in a world where you can follow smart people like you and me and the people that we follow and really draft behind really smart people. Sorry, but you could really draft behind smart people. It is crazy not to. So Jeff Richard calls it a total reboot, right? And yes, I'm against buying and Simon Properties and American Islands. Let the private equity people have them. Let the sharks go at them and feast on the carcasses and the financial leverage. Investors should be looking at software and the world digital. Okay, if you have a non-digital investing public statement, you're doing it wrong. You're going to have to pay up, but you're going to have to own, the regular investor is going to own digital companies. There's just been giant reboot. If you owned a restaurant that went out of business, you were most likely booted to an old system. Your old Visa connection, you were paying 2% this and 4%. You couldn't accept this card. Okay. Now, if you start a restaurant in New York, you're going to be thinking about it first, Grubhub, Yelp reviews. You're going to be thinking about connecting to Square and a Brex account. You're going to be thinking about how to digitally start that restaurant. How to deliver food before you worry about how your customers in store feel. So this reboot of Square, PayPal powering Mercado Libre in Asia and WeChat and Alibaba in China and India has got their companies and maybe Europe's the country that's really the furthest, the continent that's furthest behind, but Africa's being lit up crazily with all these things. There's so much opportunity to reboot the world, and that's just happening. Whether we complain about it or not, it's not inclusive of everybody, right? There's a lot of people being left behind. I mean, it's a horror show. But again, the writing was on the wall. Midtown was a stupid place to go for the last 10 years, right? Unless you were doing a startup and trying to get a really low lease somewhere, right? Okay. Because it became too expensive in Soho and Flatiron for fintech. San Francisco for the last 5 years was a disgusting place. So all COVID did was shine a light on the inefficiencies of that city. So it's not something new that COVID wrecked Midtown and wrecked San Francisco. This stuff had been moving. And so, people need to just remember that stuff. This wasn't like, oh my God, Midtown, what a shame. No, it was pretty useless for the last 10 years. And the rest of New York, lower New York from 30th Street down is back to normal, 70, 80% back to normal. Obviously, they don't have tourists. So good people are moving everywhere. And technology that allowed them to work from otherwhere, and we're going to have massive problems, Raul. I mean, that's obvious. There's culture problems, there's motivational problems, there's leadership problems. You know, how do you lead over Zoom versus leading face-to-face? I mean, let's face it, people are going to be exhausted of COVID by November. Exhausted. So don't think this is like a cakewalk, people. Like, this is, software can only overcome so many things. Still need humans, and humans need to be optimistic and motivated and have human connection and all the things that we haven't had for 6 or 9 months. And then you're going to have the headaches that come from, oh, I survived COVID for 9 months, then I went out for a beer with friends in October and I got it, you know? And I was like 6 months, like, doing everything I could. And I'm seeing that happen now with the young kids. And they're just, luckily so far, the death rates aren't high, but like the exhaustion of this COVID is going to hit too. So I do think there's a second order effect coming. And I can't predict what that is, but I don't think it's all roses.
No. Well, it's going to be fascinating. Thank you, Had, for giving you some of your time and some of your thoughts. It's really, really interesting because your perspective is very different. Because as I said, a lot of the time it's there's a very cynical view out there. And I think, yeah, you're a dyed-in-the-wool cynic like me, but you're also a massive optimist in terms of change and the investability of it.
Really, but not all of Europe. I'm bullish on like Germany and Amsterdam and certain Dutch, the Dutch, but not all of Europe. The governments are just horrible there. So anyway, that's a whole nother piece that I'm not as big an expert on. But I appreciate everything you guys are doing at Real Vision. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks, Howard. Really good to have you.